You're listening to Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The stories you're about to hear were recorded on April 3rd at the Church of the Holy Trinity. The theme for the evening was near-death experiences.
Good evening and welcome to Mudrooms. My name is Alita Buss. I'll be one of your hosts tonight.
My name is Amanda Compton. I am the co-host.
Our theme tonight is near-death experiences, something that filled up quickly. I think Junoites are a hearty bunch that way. Without further ado, our first speaker tonight is Rita Winslow, artist by day, super guard by night. Rita spends her days being artistic or outside enjoying all the weather options Juno has to offer, and her nights making sure the valley pool stays standing and that everyone's having fun. Rita didn't start off in Juno, but after hiking through knee-deep mud and G.I. Joeing off a bridge covered with a foot of snow just to go camping and finally seeing a performance at Perseverance, she can now say she's a Junoite. Here's Rita.
Good evening. Oh, wow. like they said, my actual first visit here was in the summer of 2007, and living in the lower 48, I missed a little nugget of knowledge that would have been nice to have been given through the media. For those of you that lived here through the winter of 2006, 2007, you know what I'm talking about. Southeast Alaska and the Yukon got record levels of snow. Juno themselves got 215 inches of snow, the most in Juno's recorded history. So without that nugget of knowledge, if I would have had that, I wouldn't have had my first near-death experience. So I'm traveling with my father, and we are in this granny mobile of a rental car. I'm behind my itinerary because not having realized the snow. Traveling along, I've been awake for 36 hours straight, and I'm driving along, and my dad is asleep in the back of this rental car because days earlier he had fallen on barnacles and had removed all the skin off of his foot, so he couldn't drive. So because I was behind the times, I'm pushing myself to drive. Got my coffee, everything's cool, I got music, I'm in the Yukon. Driving along, when I reach over for the cup of coffee, and it's empty. I have a 2.5-3 hour run till the next town. I'm okay, I got, CDs to listen to. So I'm driving along. All of a sudden, I do the jello neck. I'm sure you've all done it, got tired behind the wheel. Your head starts bobbing. I freaked out. Turned the heat off. Rolled the window down and found the most annoying CD I could find, popped it in. My dad is still oblivious in the back, so I'm driving along, managed to eke out another hour and a half, when the jello neck hit me again. Bobbed my head, this time I managed to hit my head on the steering wheel. So I pulled over. I know a nap would have been good, but I didn't have the time. So when I road trip, I wear sandals or slippers, pair of shorts, and a t-shirt. It was summer after all, right? So I'm like, well, maybe if I get out and walk, I'll wake up. So turned the car off, got back out, started walking. And I was, amazed at the scenery, the emerald green, the olive green, the forest green, and then the browns and the russets and all of it with this melting overlay of snow. I'm walking along on this road, and it is awe-inspiring because I'm the only thing out there, And suddenly I get this feeling that I'm being watched. So I turn around and look behind me to see if my dad was, looking out the windshield, and nothing. I'm like, well, I'm just sleep-deprived. Let's walk a little bit farther. So I keep walking. At this point, I turn around, and I am pretty far from the car. I'm like, okay, it's time to walk back. When that feeling hits me again, and the hairs on the back of my neck start to stand up, I'm looking all over the place. The only thing moving is me and the sun. So I'm like, okay, it's just me being tired. So I continue to walk, and I'm like, okay, and now I'm getting hysterical feeling, panicky. Maybe if I step off into the embankment, get my legs wet, it'll shock me awake, I'll be cool. So I proceed to do so. But instead of getting knee-deep in snow, I'm now chest-deep, right? And so I'm standing there thinking to myself, what a stupid idiot I am, I'm now chest-deep in snow. When that feeling is just so overpowering, so I'm still looking around trying to figure this out. When on the embankment above me, coming out of this forest, is a freshly risen grizzly bear. All I see is his feet, and I'm like, oh my God. what am I going to do? So I step, try and push my foot back and lean back. The same time I lean back, I hear him growl and I feel it in my chest. I froze. I'm thinking, I'm going to die. I am a human popsicle. So as I'm sitting in there thinking, you know, he's just going to reach down and snap my head off, you know. I'm standing there. I'm like, well, maybe if I take my slipper off. So I managed to get my slippers off. I'm now barefoot in snow. I try it again. I hadn't even barely moved when he growled at me again. At this point, I'm thinking, I'm so dead. I start talking. I have no idea what I'm saying, but it becomes kind of like a mantra, just in its one tone. I have no idea what I'm saying, right? I happen to glance up at this point and actually look at this bear, and he's huge. And he's got his head cocked looking at me. Like, what are you doing? I've been watching you for 10 minutes. As I'm standing there, I'm thinking, please, just go back into the forest. Please, 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 please. We stand there. We actually make eye contact. I thought, this is it. I'm dead. He cocks his head again a little farther. I swear he smirked at me. Turned around and walked back in the forest. His butt I could still see in the trees. I spun around, was doing this and running. Managed to get out of the snow. I book it all the way to the car. Completely missed the car, slid past it, scrambling, got back in, sitting there, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. When my dad goes, where were you? I scream, plaster myself under the door, swallow my heart. I'm going, we're going. Put my seatbelt on, turn the van on, and I left. That's it. Thank you.
We're thinking that maybe your head wasn't bobbing the rest of the ride. Our next speaker is Rich Lyon. Rich Lyon was born in Western Washington State in 1951 as the youngest of eight children to Montana parents Jenny and Kermit. He and his new bride Joy moved to Alaska following hydroelectric dam projects as a carpenter in 1981. Joy and Rich have lived in Juneau since 1983, and Rich has had a hand in many projects around town. He and Joy have had dinner with cannonballs in New Guinea, swam with sharks, skydived, and walked on fire, literally, together, and are a long way from done. Please welcome to the stage, Rich Lyon.
I told a friend I was going to tell a story about near-death experience at this community forum tonight. She was amazed that I had experienced such a thing. I was equally amazed that she had no such experience. I think we've all had many near-death experiences in our lives. All of us here tonight share at least one. All of us were born when the line between life and death can be very thin. As a child of five or six, I lived in a rural part of Washington State with a nice little creek flowing through our small farm. A 24-inch concrete culvert ran for about 200 feet between the house and the other outbuildings. My one-year younger brother, Lauren, and I were playing around the inlet of the culvert one lightly raining spring day. Lauren fell in, and I jumped in the creek and got hold of his wool jacket just as he started down that well-filled culvert. The nearest farmhouse was about 100 yards away and out of sight. I screamed for help as loud as I could and dug my fingers into that jacket that my mom had made from hand-me-down pieces of wool and corduroy cloth. Lauren and I were losing ground and definitely would have died if we had gone down that tunnel. I wasn't going to let go. Finally, Helen Gamble, our neighbor, heard my terrified cries for help and ran to our aid. A strong wife of a farmer, she got grip on both of us and pulled us to safety and took us to our home. A reporter from the local paper came to do a human interest story and spoke with Mom and Lauren. I watched from the back porch through the window. I was still too traumatized to talk about it. We never talked about it in our family, and I only recalled it when Lauren reminded me about it 15 or 20 years ago. He sent me the newspaper clipping. I can still smell that wet wool of the jacket he wore. I can't stand wearing a halibut jacket. that smell of wet wool. Fast forward a few years to when I was about 11. Same neighborhood, same brother. We were playing with four other kids at their house, riding bicycles around a dirt track and on makeshift motocross out back of their house. During all this rough play, one of the other kids, Mickey, and I got into a scuffle, and I accidentally tore his shirt pocket. He was enraged because he was sure he'd be punished for playing with his school clothes, or in his school clothes, after school, and ran into the house. No adults were home at 4 p.m. on a work day. He rushed back out yelling and crying and pushed a revolver into my belly and pulled the trigger. I instinctively grabbed the gun, not even knowing it was a gun, and the hammer came down on the web of my thumb. I wrestled him to the ground, wrenched the gun out of his hand. The rest of the kids, including my brother, Lauren, and Mickey's brother, Pat, and all of us, got us apart, and we tried to calm him down. I picked up the gun that was now on the ground and saw that it was a .38 caliber with six shots in the cylinder. I think that was a close one. No one mentioned it to the parents. We all went back to playing. We didn't talk about it. I do recall a head-on collision a little later with a Ford station wagon when I was about 21. I was riding a motorcycle at illegal speeds on a Saturday night and wound up in the middle of the road at 2 a.m. When I came to, I couldn't move. I heard two men speaking in the darkness. "Did anybody call for an ambulance?" said one. "No," said the other. "This guy doesn't need an ambulance. He's dead." I did a quick evaluation on my condition and realized that I couldn't move and I wasn't breathing. And then the bright lights. I gasped my first breath in as they pushed the Ford Mustang that had run over my body, lying in the middle of the road in the dark. Light mist fell on my face through my visor of my helmet as the headlights illuminated the scene. And a pickup truck pulled over in the lane ahead, and half a dozen onlookers milled around. Pretty soon an ambulance came. I was rushed off to the hospital. They x-rayed me and released me in about an hour or so. No insurance. It was a long recovery. I got the bike fixed. There were more calls, close calls, with cars and mountain climbing, boats, motorcycles, lots more. I'm still here. And on February 14th this year, Lauren, my younger brother, and my eldest brother, John, flew to Polson, Montana to visit our brother, Joe. He'd been ailing the last few years, and we all thought a visit was in order. When we arrived, we were greeted by his wife, Barb. She told us Joe had died about an hour before we arrived. We joined him at his bedside. We three remaining brothers reminisced about our times together. It's been a month or so. We've called each other a few times to talk.
Can you guys hear in the back? Yes? A little louder. Okay. Is that better? Good. Our next speaker is Corinne Bosworth. Corinne met her husband Rob almost 28 years ago in Gustavus at the Caden Solstice Goat Roast. Doesn't that sound like fun? After the dance and a motorcycle ride home, he invited her over for brunch the next day at the beautiful log house he had built in a sunny meadow. She revealed to him later that she had married him for his log house and his tier one benefits. Smart lady. He said that worked for him. But Rob took Corinne's silly joke very seriously, and like a male bowerbird, he has continued building her beautiful houses in Gustavus to this day. The latest house, another beautiful log house with all the mod cons. What are mod cons? Oh. It's available to rent if there's anyone out there having trouble with Juneau's housing market. Here's Corinne.
So my friend Jim Makoviak says there's no way I survived this experience I'm about to tell you about. He says, that I had a beyond-death experience and that I'm actually some sort of well-disguised, well-behaved zombie. Jim's well-known for his stories, and so I'm going to tell you my story and let you decide about my zombiness. In the mid-1980s, I was working in Gustavus on my master's thesis, and a friend of mine, who was also not gainfully employed that summer, suggested we go on an adventure that we've been trying to go on for a long time. Work had always gotten in the way before. Wasn't going to get on our way this time. So we decided that we were going to hike the outer coast of Glacier Bay. And 2 weeks later, the plane dropped us off on the north shore of Lituya Bay, and we headed north. Now, those of you who have been on that trip, or even have seen pictures or a map of the area, know that there's a tricky part to this trip. And as you're going up the coast, you've got the 15,000-foot fair weather range on one side, and you've got the Pacific Ocean on the other side, and all the melting snow and ice and rainfall that come off the mountains have to get to the ocean. So there's lots of rivers that cross your path. Some of them are wadeable, and lots of them are not. So this was back before the days of the fancy, lightweight, sturdy pack raft that people have now. We got our raft from some kids in Gustavus. It was a cheap plastic swimming pool toy designed to hold two small children max. But we worked out a system. It worked fine. We crossed a lot of streams in the first 6 or so days of our trip. And then on the seventh day, we came to another stream that was river that we figured was too big to cross by wading. So it was Tom's turn with the raft, to go first with the raft. So he ferried all of our gear to the other side of the river, including our boots, which I'm not sure what the safety issue was with boots, but over they went. And then he came back to get me, and I crawled into the front of the raft to make room. And Tom, who's the big guy, 6'5", and very solid, gave a big push off the bank, stepped into the raft, and went right through the bottom of it, taking with it the seam that held all the air in the raft. So all of a sudden, we were standing in 36-degree, silty, melted glacier. And even if the raft had been fixable, which it wasn't, our duct tape was on the other side of the river already. So there was really nothing for it but to wade across the river. So we abandoned ship and took a hold of each other's hand and started across. Now, remember, we had bare feet. So instantly we had numb feet. We couldn't see our feet because the river was very silty. We got about 3/4 of the way across, still doing fine, except for the fact that we were so cold. And I think we were so cold that we panicked at that point. We could see the bank just about 75 feet away. But we panicked and we started to run. And in one fairly big running step, we went from thigh deep in the river to over our heads in the river. And it took us, I don't know how long, a long time to struggle to the surface. We were still holding hands. It took us a long time to recover enough from the shock of the cold to even take a breath. And by the time we got oriented and facing downstream, we'd gone a long ways down the stream from where we had fallen in. And right in front of us, immediately in front of us, was an immense log jam. We had about 3 seconds, I figure, to take a big breath and to understand that when you go into a log jam like that, You get tangled up in the branches. You get plastered against the log and against logs, and you don't come out the other side. But down we went, in we went to this log jam, and we got scratched by lots of branches, and we bounced off logs. But 15, 20 seconds later, we got flushed out the other side. Yes. But we got oriented, facing downstream, got a big breath, thought we were free and clear, and there, coming up very fast, was huge waves of the North Pacific. And at that point, we were tired enough and weak enough from the cold and the undertow from the river was big enough and the waves were big enough. We knew that if we got washed into the ocean, that again, we were not going to come out of there, be able to make our way out of there. So we figured the only thing there was to do was to let go of hands and to swim for the bank of the river. And we did. And just before we got washed into the ocean, we drug ourselves up onto the bank. Luckily, it was the bank that our gear was on. We lay there for a while in the mud at the side of the river, and we laughed. Is that where the phrase laughing hysterically comes from? But when we could do it, we crawled up the cut bank that we were lying on and looked over the other side, and there, just 50 feet away, less, was a large, dead marine mammal, probably a sea lion, but we didn't investigate closely. And on it was a sow with three cubs. So by that time, we were numb enough that we didn't care. We weren't worried. And luckily, the sow was much more interested in the meal than she was in us. And we tiptoed past them and up the riverbank to where our gear was waiting for us. The end.
So our next speaker before the intermission is Thomas Fletcher. Fletcher grew up in New Hampshire and Connecticut, but sometimes just says Maine, because it's easier to explain. He and his family, Amy, Townsend, Olivia, and Scout the dog, have been in and out of Juneau for over 18 years, not counting the 22-year-old cat. They are currently in Juneau. Fletcher will not be discussing near-death experiences on the water. That time on Ridgeway Skiff, or Jim's sailboat, or the time with Ridgeway on Jim's sailboat, or the time off shelter with Ridgeway and Jim on their sailboat, or off Stewart or Cooper Point. I'm taking a little bit of creative liberty here. For this story, he'll avoid water stories, although he's wet for most of the story.
I just want to start by apologizing to Mark Wheeler for providing his son with his first near-death experience playing laser tag out at family camp last year. Sorry about that. When I was 16, I went away to school, to boarding school, and on the first day I met a new friend who changed my life in various ways. And he was a really sophisticated guy, like from New York. His dad was in advertising. Unlike the rest of us, he dressed really well, like pressed Oxford shirts and real jackets, not the thrift store blazers that we wore, ties. If you could imagine Don Draper's son, this was the guy. And that made me Peter's son, I'm not sure. But anyway, he had a lot to teach me. He was a true dude. And he had lots of dude lessons. The first one was don't talk too much, which I didn't never really learn that much. But But it kind of went like this. When I first met him, I was like, oh, you're from Darien? I'm from Darien, and I used to live there, and I went to Royal School, and I Leroy Avenue. Yeah, I lived there, and I had a dog named Fizz. Yeah, dude, that's really cool. Really cool, yeah. Which meant it wasn't cool at all. He taught me how to soak toilet paper in Dracor Noir and hang it from the window to mask almost any scent in the room. How to properly bootleg Grateful Dead tapes with the proper labeling. How to convince your roommates not to play Bon Jovi or Van Halen. How to meet and talk to girls. You know, he was only a sophomore, but one day we were walking and the two Cooper twins, Susan and Mary, I think, they were from Bermuda. They were like royalty, tan, and had these British accents. Hey, Chris. What's up? Hey, Tom. Hi. You know, and he was like, he gave his look and he was like, dude, I'm not sure we can be seen in public anymore. And he was sincere. For all his dudeness, he didn't last. He got kicked out, or something happened to him about halfway through the year. We weren't really sure what. His stuff was in his room. We were just told that he had some issues to take care of. And so someone had to step up to the plate and be the dude. And we were at this concert in the assembly hall in the auditorium. And we had a flask, which we sometimes did, and it was in high school, but we had this habit. And it quickly ran dry, and it was time for someone to go back to the dorm and refill it. So my best impression, Chris impression, I just grabbed the flask, didn't say a word, and got up and went to the bathroom and crawled through the window and snuck back to the dorm. And we had this system in the dorm, which was all the contraband was kept in the bathroom so that if anyone's room got searched, no individual person would ever get busted, right? It was a joint. We would all get caught at once, right? They couldn't kick us all out. And so you had to stand on the toilet seat and lift up the ceiling tile. And on one side was the empties, and on the other side was whatever we had. And in this case, we had a bottle of vodka. And I brought it down, started filling up the flask, and I'm not quite sure what happened, but I got distracted or I had an intuition, but I left. I left with a flask, and I snuck back out and went back to the auditorium. And as I was about to go in the auditorium, I looked back, and there's a teacher going to the dorm, and I realized I left the bottle out on the floor. So now I was busted. I had to wait a while, a few days. I can't remember, but I had a while to think, I think, about this, and it was probably Tuesday morning, and I was sent into the office of Mr. Enriquez. Beard, trimmed beard, but still a full beard. Blue eyes, suede coat, tie, cowboy boots. He's like the bastard son of Clint Eastwood. Yeah, Middlebury. So he's giving me this piercing look, and I'm trying to hold up, and he's like, so, Mr. Fletcher, why did you leave the assembly on Friday night? I didn't. I was there. I was there at the assembly. I know you left the assembly, and I know that you went back to the dorm, and I found a bottle there. So at this point, I thought I was going to die. Maybe not quite die, but I was sure that my life was over. And so I think when you're feeling like you're going to die or your life is over, you can be really calm and things can go in slow motion like it usually happened all those times in the boats. But this time I just panicked and I started to lie. So I told this lie about how this was all Chris's stuff and we were trying to protect him, going back to the dorm to empty out his room so that when the teachers went in there to clean it all out, they wouldn't find anything and he wouldn't get too much trouble, right? And for some reason this lie stuck. And I kept being interrogated, but I held out underneath the piercing blue eyes. And so the story kept going, but basically I was getting off by this lie. And You know, I was kind of proud of it, but I was also kind of like thinking about the trouble you can get into when you're not really being the person that you really are. And I was also thinking about the thing I didn't know at the time but became evident later was that while teenage boys seem brainless and monosyllabic, yeah, they actually have a code, like the mafia. Silence, you know, don't talk too much, the dude code. If you get caught, you take the rap, you don't blame other people for it. And I had broken this rule, because if there's one thing, just like the mafia, when you get caught and you nothing bad happens to you, there's no consequences. You must be a rat, right? So anyway, I got off for that year, and everything was fine until the next fall when I came back to school and my new roommate was Chris.
You're listening to Mudrooms on KTOO 104.3 FM. Next up is Bruce Denton. Bruce came to Juneau in 1971 to earn enough money to finish his undergraduate degree at the University of Washington, where he competed as a varsity gymnast while pursuing his goal of attending University of Washington Dental School, where he had been accepted as an alternate. Instead, he fell in love with Juneau, and a local elementary school teacher, got married, took up dog mushing, ran the Iditarod 4 times, raised a family, started a construction business, earned enough money to help his 4 kids graduate from college, never left Juneau, and never looked back. Never looked back, that is, until he switched his dog mushing avocation for downhill skiing and took up the sport of sculling, where looking back is the norm, and not looking forward, as you will hear, would have cost him his life last summer were it not for the selfless act of 4 Good Samaritans. He has 2 rowing shells which are appropriately named Hindsight and Retrospect. Bruce is currently the president of the Juneau Rowing Club and blames his near-death experience 100% on pilot error and not as an indictment of the sport of sculling, which he loves to share with others and which he aggressively pursued as soon as he was medically cleared following his accident. Bruce Denton.
Wow, she's good. You know, I have a confession. They send you all this information that when you're going to be a speaker to prepare yourself properly. So last night I sat up all night writing what I wanted to read or to speak, and I got all done writing it, and I thought, oh, I better see how long this is going to take. So I read it and timed myself. It took 15 minutes. So I thought, well, that's not going to work. So I hacked it all up and got it down to 7 minutes, and I read it again, and I thought, you know, if I'm trying to paraphrase it, I'm probably not going to be able to do it in 7 minutes. It's going to take longer. And anyway, I read it. I decided I hated it. So I'm winging it. And probably what I should have done was just handed her what I wrote and let her read it, because she probably would have made it sound okay. Anyway, if I run out of time, you guys know that I had a boating accident and I'm here, so I made it. And if you don't hear the rest of the story, give me a call. So, last August we had a couple of nice days, and I chose one of those to sneak away from work and go for a row. So I rode down to the zip line on the Gatineau Channel and came back to the rowing club float at the corner of Aurora Harbor there, you see as you drive into town from the valley. And I decided, well, I'm feeling pretty frisky, so I think I'll do one more wind sprint. So I took off from the rowing float heading towards town between the main float of Aurora Harbor and the access road there. And the tide was high, so there was plenty of room between the dock and the beach. And I was going 10.5 miles an hour looking at my speedometer on my rowing shell when I hit the back of my head on the H float ramp. And it knocked me out instantly, and I ended up in the water just seconds later. So, you know, most bad things that happen like this, it's a chain of things. You know, one bad thing happens, another bad thing happens, another bad thing happens. Well, the second bad thing that happened after being stupid was nobody saw it happen. And if somebody told me that I was going to die rowing a boat in the boat harbor 10 feet from the beach, I would have said, you know, I could write a list of 10,000 things that I've done, and that would have been right there with jaywalking on Franklin Street in the winter. And but what happened with me was, other than the two dumb things, or the two bad things, is everything else went right. So it just so happened that as I was rowing, toward before I hit, Bert and Crystal Fawcett, who live in the boat harbor, were driving out the road, out the access road to get to Egan Drive and leave. And Bert refuses to drive when he's talking on a telephone. So fortunately, he took a telephone call just seconds after I hit the ramp. They couldn't see me any longer because they were at the end of the H float ramp. So he stopped his car and parked, and Crystal had seen me rowing just, you know, before he took the phone call. So I had the great benefit of having them stop. Crystal sat in the car and listened to Bert talk on the phone for a while, got bored and got out of the truck, walked across the street and to the top of the H float, and noticed that my boat had stopped and it was upside down and it was just north of the float. So she kind of looked at it for a while and realized that something was wrong. Thought, well, maybe he's going to do an Eskimo roll. Well, you don't do Eskimo rolls in rowing shells, but she saw what she thought was a red life jacket and realized it was blood. So she screamed, and Bert and another fellow, Jerry Burns, who was in the parking lot, ran rushing down the ramp, dove in the water, and went to drag me back out of the water. So Jerry hadn't been swimming for 27 years. He was a swimmer in high school, a competitive swimmer in high school. Dove in the water, I'm under the boat. He grabs my head, pulls me up out of the water. He's got my head cradled in his arm as he comes out of the water, and he's, you know, I'm inches away from his face, and he looks at me and realizes that, you know, I'm unconscious, not breathing, foam in my mouth, eyes open, eyes roll back. He says, "I think this guy's dead." So they tried to swim back to the dock. Couldn't make much progress because my feet were strapped to the boat. And so we were pulling this 24-foot boat sideways, wearing their clothes, their shoes. And meanwhile, the third Good Samaritan, John Feller, who lives on a houseboat just up from the ramp, heard all the commotion and jumped off of his houseboat, took two steps to go down and help. He couldn't see from his vantage point, but he knew that there were people in the water. Took two steps, stopped. You guys might not hear the end of the story. Stopped, turned around, jumped on his boat, grabbed a deck brush that had a great big long handle, went running back down, and it was just long enough to reach out in the water to pull these guys, pull the guys in. So they pulled me up onto the dock, but they did that with great difficulty because I was still attached to the boat. So whichever one was still in the water, I'm sorry, had to undo the Velcro straps that were holding my feet to the boat, which was what kept me from sinking. My life jacket wasn't deployed because it was a ripcord on a CO2 cartridge. Pulled me up onto the dock, and to my good fortune, he had worked as a deckhand on a commercial diving boat, so he knew how to do CPR. So they did CPR and got me breathing. It was 8 minutes from the time that I went into the water until they got me breathing. And Capital City Fire and Rescue came down, grabbed me, hauled me off to the emergency room. I got to the emergency room. Dr. Thompson said, "I think we're going to have to medevac you. Your lungs are pretty compromised." And the rationale was that there's no pulmonologist in Juneau. And so he put an oxygen mask on me and told me, to the extent that I could, to try and hold my breath, to force the fluid that was in my lungs into my bloodstream, which I did with difficulty. Breathing was kind of like sucking on a Slurpee with six straws with holes in it. It was just gurgling. I don't know how long it was, but it wasn't very long before he sent me off to the ICU unit. And the next morning, I was released from the hospital. And he said the best thing to do is stay away from schools and hospitals because you're really susceptible to pneumonia. And the more that I could exercise my lungs, the better. So I went for a walk that night. I live on Montana Creek Road, and we walked down to the skater's cabin. I couldn't walk and talk at the same time. And every day for the next several weeks, I was like a noticeable difference in my stamina. And within a month, my heart palpitation stopped, and I think I'm pretty much back to normal. And I'd like to take this opportunity to ask everybody in the audience who is trained in CPR to raise your hands. Now put your hand down if you're not current. I'm alive for a whole bunch of reasons, and that was the last of them, was that I had a guy that knew how to do CPR, and so I do have a copy of the Red Cross schedule for CPR classes for the next 2 months. If anybody wants to look at it, it's got it here. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Rory Watt. Rory Watt is a 20-year resident of Juneau and a proud father of two teenage boys. Between 1987 and 89, he lived as a Peace Corps volunteer in Sierra Leone, a small West African country that is the third roundest country in the world. We're learning lots tonight. During a two-month period in the fall of 1988, he nearly died repeatedly. Here he is tonight to tell you some of the reasons that he really believes that he is the luckiest man on the face of this earth. He also believes that you are each equally lucky. Here's Rory.
It was the summer of 1988, and I was 24, and I'd been in Sierra Leone for about a year. I'd recently had worms, giardia, amoebic dysentery, and malaria. I just had a tumbu fly removed from my leg. Envision, if you will, a big pimple on your thigh, except it wasn't a zit. The nurse worked and squeezed my leg. Out popped a maggot. But none of those things came close to killing me, or at least I don't think they did. But my six-week run of luck of all kinds was about to start. I lived in a small rural village with about 3,000 people. There was no plumbing, electricity, phone, pavement, or many hints of modern life. A dusty road ran through town, a couple of cars and trucks every hour. I was the only foreigner, the only white person. My house had mudblock walls covered with a smear of cement, faded whitewash. I had a covered veranda, wooden shutters covered window openings, and it had a metal roof. The windows had strips of wood across them, and they were called teef bars for keeping the teefs, or thieves, out. Isatu, my neighbor, would say, "Oh, Mr. Lorry, never leave your door open. Snakes will come into your house." One night I awoke with severe pain in my stomach. I knew the drill, lit my kerosene hurricane lamp, and headed for the pit latrine, literally a hole in the ground. No bowel movement was forthcoming. I hobbled back to my house. On this night, something was different. I pulled out my faithful self-help book, issued to all Peace Corps volunteers, Where There Is No Doctor, and went to the index to look up abdominal pain. The entry humorously said, "See belly." Under the belly section, I quickly found out how to diagnose the difference between ulcers, parasites, and the eventual winter appendicitis. In the morning, I took an hour-long bouncy truck ride down a severely potholed dirt road further into the jungle to a smaller town that had a rudimentary hospital. Appendicitis and bouncy rides do not go together. There were no doctors at the hospital. Janet Baxter was a nice English 23-year-old studying to become a gynecologist. She had never done an appendectomy, but she had done a C-section. She was game, and I had no choices. Everyone in the operating room was barefoot. Leave your shoes and therefore as much dirt and disease as possible at the door. They scrubbed up with homemade lye soap. It was called brooking soap because you used it to wash your clothes in the stream or brook. When she anesthetized me, I looked into her eyes, and I could see that she was scared. The worst part were the hallucinations from whatever they drugged me up with. I felt and saw my body twisting and contorting, my head folding through my stomach and out the back and back on. They wheeled me in a gurney outside down some gravel paths. All the alien creatures I passed, they had big distended necks that came up with misshapen heads, and they peered over and looked down at me. After the surgery, since I was white, I was put in my own one-room building, away from the nursing staff, who unfortunately couldn't hear me hollering in pain all through the night. Out of fear of giving me too much, they had underdosed the painkillers. My first visitors came at dawn, goats who came to eat the orange rinds on the veranda. One pushed the door open, stuck its head in the room, and stared at me for a bit. Later, the doctor came. "You'd be amazed how hard you have to cut to get through skin. Your appendix popped right out." Back at home, 3 weeks later, I watched yet another spectacular tropical lightning show. As I was putting away my laundry, I put a shirt on a metal hanger. I reached up to hang it on the pole that hung from the ceiling, from the metal roof in the humid jungle. Bam! The room exploded. Everything was in black and white. My body convulsed. It was like I'd been hit by a truck. I knew I was being hit by lightning. I screamed as hard as I could. No! I didn't want to die. I slammed to the ground, knocked unconscious. I jolted awake with my heart racing. I couldn't move most of my body. My right arm and legs were paralyzed. With my left arm, I could push myself on the back, and I cried for help. My neighbor Saidu and his brother came to the window. They smashed through the teeth bars, crawled over my bed, dragged me across the floor. I looked down at my legs, no feeling or sensation at all. Saidu looked at me. "The only thing left to do is to pray to God." And they jumped back out the window and they left. I lay in bed, and with my left hand, I kneaded my right hand, thinking, "Please, I want to have some feeling back. Let me have some feeling back." And after about half an hour, I could feel some tingling in my fingertips. Later, Patrick, the dispenser, came. He ran a small business selling matches, cigarettes, aspirin, Band-Aids, and Valium out of a wooden box propped on a crate. "Here, take these pills. These are for brain injuries." He cleaned the wound where my head had hit the ground. Through the night, I slowly regained feeling in my body. In the morning, I sent a note to another Peace Corps volunteer who lived a few miles away. Her parents were visiting. They had rented a Land Rover, an impossible luxury. "Hey, Catherine, how's your parents' visit going? Hope you guys are having a great time. Do you think it'd be possible to borrow your Land Rover to go to Freetown? Got hit by lightning last night." She saved the letter. Back in Freetown, Dr. Zeller was very excited. He had never had a lightning patient before. He ran home to get his camera. Click, he took my picture. The hair in my right armpit was burned to a stubble. I had a red stripe burned down the side of my body about the severity of sunburn. I had two red stripes down the inside of my legs, the hair singed off the inside of my legs. He recommended saltwater rehydration therapy. That meant go to the beach and have a beer. There was nothing else to be done. He wrote a note on the photo, "Battle scars from the toughest job you'll ever love." 3 weeks later, I was lying in bed reading, and Isatou came over. "Oh, Mr. Lorry." We laughed, and I looked up, and from my mosquito net, a snake was weaving through the air towards her head. I screamed, she screamed, we ran. Saidu and James charged into my house with big sticks. They bludgeoned the snake to death. It was a Dovok boy, very poisonous. I vividly remember looking at the fangs. The snake had slithered up the teeth bar where it had been left propped against the window. When I think about how tenuous life is, how unlikely the biological process of conception and birthing and eating and breathing is, I'm amazed that any of us are actually alive at all. I really believe that we are all incredibly lucky. Just to be here today, an impossible number of things have to go right every single day. And amazingly, most of us defeat death day after day. I hope that I go on not dying for another 30 or 40 years, maybe longer. And I hope that you do too.
So, this next guy, he is a musician, multimedia artist, and magician. He enjoys lucid dreaming, astral projection, tarot reading, occult studies, and walks in the woods. He aspires to someday be famous for no good reason whatsoever. As a child, he once ate a live scorpion. Some things in life, he says, are just meant to sting. And his name is George Kuhar.
Hello. Okay, so I've always been really curious about life and death and that whole process, and fortunately for me, I was given the opportunity to find out a lot, get really close to death. I was born with a hereditary kidney condition, and that meant that sometime in my late 20s, I was going to have kidney failure. And not only that, dying by kidney failure is not something that sneaks up on you. Your body stops processing fluids, and you start to fill up with water. You see it in your ankles first, and then it gets up to your knees, and then to your waist. And I've waited until the water was up to my heart before I went into the emergency room, with my arm around my wife's shoulder. And now, a healthy person, they measure your kidney health with your creatinine number, and a healthy person's number is 0.6, 0.7 or so. I walked into the ER that day, and my creatinine level was 18, almost 20 times what it's supposed to be. And my doctor, Dr. McPherson, he was really cool, and he was a little Scottish guy. He's very, very nice, and somebody knows him. He said, George, we got to send you to Anchorage. We got to put you on a plane. We got to send you to Anchorage. We need a stool sample first. Give me a cup of coffee. I'll bring it. No, we don't have time. And he puts his glove on. And okay. So they get me on the Learjet. I'm on my first ever private Learjet experience. And I'm lying down in the bed, and they got you all wrapped up good, and they needles and hoses coming in me, and I'm right next to the window. It's right there. And then I'm lying there, and I feel this warm rush come over me. And I think, oh, that's weird. And I said, what was that? And the in-flight nurse says, oh, well, we just gave you some morphine for the pain. And I said, oh, okay. And I looked out the window, and the sun was rising over the Chilcats, and I started to sing to myself. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. I'm the Rocket Man. Rocket Man. They sent me to Anchorage. They got me all fixed up. I went on dialysis treatments, and I started feeling better. The interesting thing was that not too long after that, I had a vision. And if any of you have had a vision, you know that a vision is not like a dream. A vision is not like an hallucination. A vision is something very unique unto itself, And the main difference is a vision has a vibration, and that vibration changes you instantly. And so in this vision, I met a man named Joseph, and he wanted to show me something. And he led me down some dark stairs, and we went down into this underground place, and we walked around down there. And I was walking behind him, and he turned, and he went out the exit. And the exit was dark. And I stopped, and I looked. And then in my peripheral, I noticed someone was flashing a light in a figure eight. And I looked at it, and then it stopped right on me. And as I set my gaze upon it, it just exploded into this humongous light, and it was just huge, and it took up the entire room, and it moved in a way that I cannot explain. The best I can say is that it was like diamonds. It was like liquid diamonds in a sea of white burning fire, and it roared. It roared very loud. It roared like 1,000 waterfalls, like being on the inside of a vacuum cleaner. It was so, so, so loud, and it grabbed me, and it held me. And I sat there, and it vibrated me, and it shook me to the deepest core that I didn't even know that I had. And I said, "Thank you, God." And when that happened, I sat up in bed, and that vibration was still with me. And I could feel it, and it stayed with me, and it stayed with me. And then sometime after that, I went to the Twilight Cafe, which is the old house of the longtime Juneau resident, Joe Sonman. And the connection that I have to that house is that's the house that I first lived in when I came to Juneau. And I went in there, and I had a cup of coffee, and I looked around, and I thought, well, it's very different in here than when I lived here. And Joe Sonman had since passed on. After I left the Twilight Cafe, I was filled with this urge, and I got a pen and paper, and I started to write. And I'm certain that it was Joe Sonman saying something. And this is what he said. "When I was alive, alive with my pride and with my stride that I could never, ever, ever hide, I became sick at the end of my wick. And God knows I won't come back so quick. So when I died, it split me far and wide, a moonless night and an empty tide. And now that I am dead, alone in my bed, you bake my life into your bread. And I will always be there, right by your side. And you will always be here, right by mine." Everybody, did you know that every day you have about 50 million cells die? Life is a near-death experience, and we are in debt to death. And I just love that. Have a good night.
This is KTOO News Juneau 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on April 3rd. The theme for the evening was Near Death Experiences. Audio production by Mark Wheeler.